This is the sound.
And good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another snowy edition of Warrior Connection. Well, this is Doug Rocky, and I'm speaking to you from snowy Illinois. A couple of us are out here in snowy Illinois, and Denise is going to join us from Denver. I guess they had snow yesterday. Denise, are you there?
Yes, I'm here, ready to do an update.
Well, how about that? We haven't heard an update for a while, so Denise, why don't you... Hey, you know, it's 23 years to this weekend, this week, when we launched the Desert Storm and all the catastrophe after that, isn't it?
It sure is. Been a long, long time, and long time to get people help, too.
You know, one of the things that bothers me most, and you were totally involved in this, you know, one of my original depleted uranium assessment team members showed up on the Internet, and you were involved in this, and as we found out 23 years after the fact, or after I ordered his medical care, and we cleaned up all the DU-friendly fire, and his 88's in the photograph, as you've seen, we're still finding out that the team didn't get the prompt and optimal medical care that Shinseki ordered. And I don't even know where to go. Where do we go from that, Denise? What's the update in Washington?
Well, okay. Basically, I have a couple of dates for people to put on their calendar. March 12th, as you know, our last IOM report, and I testified on a panel with David Winnett and Anthony Hardy and Angie, and then we had the researchers. They have a report coming out on defining definition of the illness. So that's coming out on March 12th from the National Academy of Science Institute of Medicine. Be released about 11 o'clock Eastern Time. It will be on their website, okay? So you go to the National Academy of Science Institute of Medicine, and it'll be on their website. So that's March 12th. March 19th, the Research Advisory Committee for Illness is having a call-in conference. Basically, this is the last chance for the researchers to, you know, put any recommendations for the report that's finishing up from the RAC, which will be presented on April 28th and 29th, Monday and Tuesday, in Washington, D.C. We're having a group of Gulf War vets show up for this, going to be there for the RAC meeting, go to the Hill on the next 2 days to talk to legislators, senators, and reps, meet as many and talk to as many as we can. So this is a big report coming out. We're there also supporting Mr. Benz, our chairman. The VA wants to end his term as chairman come, I think, September 30th, and we cannot afford to lose him. He's done a lot of work for Gulf War vets, bringing the researchers together, keeping updated on any research, reviewing the research, making their recommendations. We've had a lot of problems with the VA interrupting and interfering with the RAC committee. We hope we can turn that around. We did have two new members of the committee that showed up on the last meeting. And so Dr. Klimas is on the committee now, and also Fiona, who does animal research in Florida. So there are two key people. We're glad we have those. And we'll have to see how it advances. You know, they replaced about half of the committee, and then they intend to replace the other half. So we want to keep good people on. We want to keep Mr. Jim Benz as chairman. So we're up there to support him, support our researchers that are really being diligent and doing good research to get the ideas on the diagnostic and more so treatment. It's really turning to treatment modalities and trying to find some treatment for this. So this is the big push now, is to find treatment.
You know,
in the meantime, we're still fighting with the VA over claims, over help from them to do the right thing. And we had Senator Sanders on the bus bill, the biggest one in history, come up. And for us, as far as Gulf War, it would have helped our Gulf War vets that need their wives to help them or their spouses. The caregiver extension bill was in there to cover, you know, Gulf War, Vietnam, Korea, you know. And it was killed over a budgetary issue. They were going to fund this through the overseas fund, and that fund has you know, gosh, they have spent that money on other things to develop Afghanistan and much, you know, a whole list of things that not directly affecting veterans, I guess indirectly, but was felt that this could be done to cover the cost over a 10-year period, and that's what they killed the bill on for now. But Sanders is not giving up, and if you put in Senator Sanders and omnibus bill, you'll get a whole breakdown from military.com to Military Times. It's a shame that we had the Republicans trying to push on to that bill a sanction on Iran. My feeling and most of the veteran organizations is that you should not mix in policy with veterans' needs. And that's what the group of Republicans did. They couldn't get that sanction bill to the floor any other way, so they were going to tack it on to the, you know, veterans' omnibus bill. And that was a contention, plus the other contention was the cost and where it was going to come from.
It's just a nightmare. Well, ladies and gentlemen, well, Denise, let's bring Bob Kaler in. Bob Kaler, welcome to Warrior Connection.
Hi, Dad. Good to be here.
Hey, well, ladies and gentlemen, Bob Kaler is a syndicated columnist, author, writer, researcher, investigative journalist, reporter. I mean, the two of us have worked together. He's worked for veterans. He's written articles, I don't know, for years and years and years to help veterans. You've gone out. You've talked to them. I mean,
yeah.
Wow.
I think veterans support our troops, but support them in a real way, you know. Support them coming home, support them finding, you know, becoming whole with their lives again and all of that stuff. I think the best peace warriors in the world are veterans that come back and go, no more war. That was wrong.
You know, so, one of the strange things in all this stuff, and I know you've gone out and you've spoken to a lot of veterans, you've gone to a lot of conferences, you and I have been together and looked
yes.
into this stuff. You know, why is it, and I get from a journalist point of view, and you worked for the Chicago Tribune for, God, forever and ever, ever.
I was there for 14 years, and,
yeah.
I, and I'm still there, as a, I'm still syndicated by them, too. So it's,
you know, that's important.
Yeah.
What is it? Why do we see this? As Denise mentioned, all this stuff gets killed in Congress. Everybody
yeah.
wants to type policy on this. Why is the problem, and this is an ongoing, never-ending one,
yes.
why do we always see the fact that you come up and what the military, like on our own team, the DU team, we, that, you know, the fact, well, it didn't happen, they weren't there, the people weren't sick.
Yes.
And then, as we know, this last week, another member of my team, the original DU team, who's in
yeah.
the photograph with us, showed up needing help.
Uh-huh.
Why is it that people will say support and help the troops, but when it comes down to push to shove, everybody runs the other way because they don't want to acknowledge the incredible health effects of U.S. military operations,
right.
whether it's overseas or right here in Chanute Air Force Base in Illinois?
Right. Well, I mean, I'm sure there's lots of reasons. Certainly, as a journalist, I blame the media. 80%, 85%, 90%. I mean, it's the media doesn't, you know, does a very poor, inadequate, and sporadic job reporting, you know, the stuff beyond, you know, the big headlines, the story, the glory, you know, the mission accomplished stuff. You know, suddenly it just breaks down into not real news. You know, ailing vets. That's just not the kind of story that the media is interested in, except, you know, for the occasional scandal or what have you. But the media is, you know, is tapped into, you know, I call it the military-industrial media complex. You know, they're all wrapped together. You know, war is good, you know, in, you know, up front, you know, the war, the next war is always great. The next war is always full of glory. But the old wars that are over and done with, except for the illness and the dying and the, you know, and the trauma and the, you know, psychological trauma, that's no fun, and nobody wants to, that's not what support our troops means, apparently. I mean, it's horrible. It's horrible. And I, you know, and I, you know, I'm kind of devoting my career to fighting that kind of thing.
Now, one of the things that, I mean, the most astonishing thing about your writing, your career, and your book that you wrote, I mean, you know, courage grows at, the, you know, where the wound at the heart and all this stuff. But I think what you have found and what your investigator reporting, you've tied this thing all together where the troops come back wounded, ill, sick. They come back psychologically and physiologically destroyed.
Yeah.
They don't have the support network. But then it all falls apart when it gets to the family and the family support and the whole justice issues, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, yeah, I mean, well, the family is a frail, you know, in, a few, I mean, so much trauma comes home in one individual vet, you know, that a family can't contain that kind of trauma. You need help. You need the whole community behind you in a full way, in a real way. One of the most useful bits of terminology that I've come upon in recent years is the term moral injury, replacing or elaborating the idea of PTSD. PTSD is a diagnosis that turns someone into a patient. Moral injury means that you have been damaged, you know, in your psyche, in your conscience, and it brings you back into the idea of, you know, of being a citizen. It brings you, that's what the writer and vet Tyler Boudreaux said. Moral injury made me a citizen. PTSD made me a mental patient, and moral injury made me a citizen. And I, what's missing is that, I mean, when vets come home alone. They'll get together among themselves, but they don't come home as part of the community. But they left as part of the community. Supposedly, we all sent, you know, the vets off to war, giving them our blessings, et cetera, et cetera. But we didn't, you know, but that's just the illusion. That's the illusion of war, which is the war that hasn't been fought yet. And once the wars have, you know, once the war has been fought and the individuals have been shattered, they're not supported the way they were supported as they were sent off to do whatever.
Now, the other part, too, and I mean, this bothers me, and Denise, if you're still there, I mean, you and I have talked about this stuff, but we see so often, all of us were sent to war. Denise and I are definitely involved from Vietnam through Desert Storm and continue on with all this stuff. But all the veterans, he's sent off with this myth and this lie about we're going to war, what we're about, what we're going over there to do.
Yes.
And then all of a sudden, and you've heard this over and over again, and you've written about this, all of a sudden they find out, my God, I was lied to. This isn't the truth. I'm not out there defending our rights. There's no country really doing any damage to us. We're looking at economic control, economic gain, economic power. We're looking at sales of military weapons. What happened? What, I mean, as you've been writing and talking to veterans for years and years and years on this,
yes,
what happens to them? Is it just a total disillusion that then comes back and affects the whole family?
Yes. Well, I think once the disillusion sets in, the conscience also comes back. You know, anything that they participated in, any killing of the enemy, I mean, all of that comes back and comes back to haunt them, and they're left dealing with it all by themselves or the family, you know, but the larger, you know, the country itself is not there to support them. The country itself, you know, is out there looking at the next war or the next, you know, place where its vital interests are, on the line or whatever. And by vital interests, I mean its economic interests, its political and strategic interests, you know. And you know, I mean, war is, you know, 75% public relations. And, you know, after the war has been fought, you know, and it's just nothing but reality, there's no public relations left. It's just injured and wounded people left to deal with the consequences of what they were told and what to do and what they've done. And, you know, and the injuries they received, they're left to deal with that so much on their own. I mean, even physically, as you know, the VA doesn't take care of the vets in the manner that they deserve by any means. And, you know, and psychologically and spiritually, no, it's not even in the question. It's, you know, if you're wounded in the conscience and you're haunted, well, that's a psychological problem, but, you know, something to be fixed with a drug or something like that.
Now, with a journalist, okay?
Yeah.
And you've been doing this, an investigative journalist. You've done all kinds of stuff. You supervise journalists. You've done research. You've put it together. You've gone out on the scene. I mean, I've been with you when
yeah.
you've been one-on-one out to talk to people. What is it? Is there something that's happened today with journalists where they don't dig into it to find the primary documents? They don't talk to the primary individuals, do the research as necessary, and then report the information back? It's sort of like, well, you know, the Pentagon said this, or the Pentagon did this, or the car did this, or the truck did this.
Yes.
But there's always some real person behind this stuff and responsible for the action. But it seems like journalists, they don't report that anymore. What has happened, or how did that come to be?
Well, I would say that there is still, you know, a fair amount of decent investigative journalism that goes on. Even investigative journalists, like you know, VA scandal came up. You know, I mean, there was investigation that did create, you know, information and news about this, but there's the mainstream or the, you know, there's the, you know, we live in this 24/7 media world, and so there's just this blast of one headline after another, and without anything more than cursory, you know, research, you know, devoted to any particular story, you know, the term stenographers to power, stenographers of power, is used to describe, you know, the Washington media, and it's horribly, horribly true. I mean, read the run-of-the-mill stories, the stories that make up most of the, you know, of the news that we get, and this is not deeply thoughtfully researched. It's just reiterating what, you know, the powerful are saying, and, you know, and if there's, you know, and if there's controversy, it's a Republican Democrat kind of controversy, and not a, you know, and not any kind of controversy pulling in larger questioning of a war itself. I mean, certainly if we go back to the beginning of Desert Storm or the beginning of all of the, I mean, the beginning of Iraq, beginning of Afghanistan, all of that stuff, the way the media covered the lead into to those two big wars that are still bleeding, you know, we're still hemorrhaging from. There was serious, huge, you know, many protests and lots of questioning of those wars by the public at large that never found its way into the media. That was just, you know, it's not that it wasn't a lack of investigative reporting that closed the door on that. It was something far more pernicious, you might say, which is an absolute refusal to open the media to voices that were opposed to invading Iraq in particular. So it's not so much the lack of investigative reporting as something worse than that. It's the lack of serious questioning of power itself. And that has been the case for maybe the last 30 years or so, dating back to the Reagan era, back in the 70s and the 80s, back into the 70s, certainly the media, finally opened up the door on Watergate and that sort of thing. And the media turned against LBJ and Nixon and Vietnam, and there was some serious questioning going on. But that door has been shut, and there has been nothing like that in 3 to 4 decades now.
Now, one of the things, and we try to tie all this together, because I know you're totally involved in this, and you've taken it the next massive leap. When the soldier or the warrior, just like anyone that's damaged, they come back to their community.
Yes.
Now, within their own community, you have all the family disintegration. You got the disintegration in the school. You got the disintegration in the crime. You got all these social and cultural problems. Now, in a lot of these communities in the inner city, and you've worked both areas, and you know the inner city in depth, you have these social cultural problems that are there in the guys that get sent to war, that can't deal with it while they're in war. They come back. They couldn't deal with the issues that they had in their own families before the war. Now they get damaged beyond comprehension. They come back, and now they try to deal with all these issues, and it falls apart, doesn't it?
Right. Yes, absolutely.
And what, I mean, you're seeing this, and you've been reporting on this a lot, haven't you?
Yeah. Well, yes. I mean, it's just such a misplacement of priorities from top to bottom. There's so little spent on any kind of domestic aid for anything at all. There's never any challenge or question when weapons programs are going to be developed, and it's time to overthrow the regime in Libya. I mean, there's never any question about that, and the money is always there for that. The money is always there to go to war, yet the money does not seem to be there to help the shattered individuals that fought the war recover. Any more than the money is there to fix the school system, to rebuild the nation's infrastructure and that sort of thing, or to really create jobs. That money does not seem to be there, and that money is always controversial. But the money to go to war seems to be always there, and it's a serious, troubling situation that as far as I'm concerned, just has gotten more and more troubling over the years. When Obama was elected, it seemed to be the beginning of something, a change. It looked like the door was opening to a whole different way of being as a nation. And it's been a huge disappointment these last 6 years now. And
I can remember, when you and I first met and everything,
we
were buying into Obama and talking to him and working with the staff and believing all of this stuff, one-on-one personally. And it was just kind of like, what happened to all these dreams and hopes that we would talk about that people anticipated?
Right. Well, I think it ran into the Washington consensus. It ran into what former congressional staffer Michael Lofgren has recently had this essay that's out on the internet in a lot of places called "The Deep State." It's the state that exists beyond the politics. It's the state that is that runs itself, that it seems to be untouchable, by the public will, by anybody that challenges the military industrial, the corporate status quo. There's just no reaching that. It's got a life of its own, and even you know, a presidential, you know, presidential politics does not reach that deeply. But of course, that's always been the case. I mean, well, it's been the case for so long that the presidential debates are always enormously superficial, and they never cut down to real issues. It's, you know, the media is there as sort of the bouncer to keep serious issues out of the debates, and only those people that agree to talk in platitudes are allowed into the debate, and it's a very frustrating situation. Frustrating is not an adequate word in this case. It's as frustrating as anything I've ever encountered in my life.
So what you're describing is a shadow government or another state up and beyond the state. I mean, we've got the three parts, you know, where we're supposed to have the balance.
Yes.
But in reality, there's something far more sinister and far more happening, because it seems like the economic control doesn't change, the drive to war doesn't change, the demand or somehow to make this the next enemy that comes after everything. I'm sitting here watching the news this morning, and all this stuff is breaking loose, you know, all over the world, throughout the Middle East. And I go back to, you know, the February of 1998 directive we had to overthrow the Taliban because of the pipeline deal for Unocal.
Yeah.
And in that same memo, if you remember, it says, well, we got to run the pipeline not only south, we got to go to Soviet Georgia, but we got to go back west. And lo and behold, guess what's all on the news right now? I mean, the next part of that whole original 98 memo is it's got to come about to happen to keep control, because if the Soviets and if the United Nations or the NATO doesn't control that pipeline coming out of west to the west,
right,
it all falls apart. And Russia controls all the oil and gas resources that are necessary for southern and Europe and all over right now, isn't it?
Exactly.
Why don't people see this? I mean, you know, they talk as, well, you're going to peace, justice, and freedom and all this stuff, and has absolutely nothing to do with that unless I'm missing something. It's all about economic control and political control and power.
Yes.
And then we set up one to make these guys look like the enemy.
Right.
And then we go in there and we destroy and we kill and contaminate.
Control,
send our kids
destroy,
in there to kill and destroy, and they come back and they can't get care.
Right. Oh. Yeah, well, as I say, war is, you know, I don't know, 75% public relations. That's the main thing. I mean, and, you know, and it's apparently not that hard to mobilize, you know, the nation to, you know, a combination of fear and, fear and compassion. You know, we don't want, you know, we've got to keep them from Iran from getting its nuclear program, but we want to, you know, save the people and bring in the democracy, et cetera, et cetera. And so that seems to be the PR mix that's necessary, you know, to go to war. Getting back to the idea of the media, I mean, what did fails to do in so many ways, as far as I'm concerned, as well as just investigating the truth of various claims, what it fails to do is even begin to recognize is that there are options other than going to war to create peace, to make the world, I mean, even to bring about people's, you know, our own interests. There are options other than going to war. There's a great organization that I have some familiarity with called the Nonviolent Peace Force that sends peacekeeping teams to various countries around the world. I had a talk with one of the directors and co-founders recently that talked about, sending a couple thousand peacekeepers into Syria to help calm down the civil war that's going on and that sort of thing. I mean, that's not even, something like that isn't even seen as an option. Anytime there's trouble, the only option that the media reports on is, you know, is the military option. So the public has no awareness that there are any other options, geopolitically speaking, than military, you know, action of one sort or another.
Well, I mean, you and I both have a personal hero, Kathy Kelly.
Yeah, okay.
You know, and I mean, she is dedicating her life to peace and justice and trying
yes.
to find ways to get out in and out of Iraq, the Middle East, every place under the earth. Wherever there was trouble, she's been in there trying to sort it through and try to get help into people, whether it's medical needs or whatever it is.
Yeah.
And it seems like there's, you know, just a handful of voices out there screaming in the wilderness.
Right. Well, yeah, somebody like Kathy is just a, you know, she, I mean, I don't know what term even to use. She, you know, she's the, you know, the saint of the anti-war movement. I mean, she puts her body on the line. She, you know, will go and be a witness to peace, you know, when the bombs begin to fall. And, you know, and is always doing something that challenges herself physically to publicize peace and to publicize, you know, the wrong, whether it's, you know, the nuclear weapons buildup or, you know, Iraq, Afghanistan, Palestine. You know, she, yes, Kathy is somebody to, I don't know, she's somebody to emulate, somebody to look to as a role model, that's for sure.
I mean, she's a real saint. I mean, a living
yeah.
saint. I mean, she's an angel. I mean, how many people has she helped directly and deliberately and willfully with medical supplies or anything else? I mean, it's not that she talks about it. She actually does it.
Right, exactly.
You know,
yeah, and there are a few people out there that do that stand there on the front lines, you know, and stand and face the violence nonviolently. And that is Kathy, and that, you know, she's one of the people that does that. And I would love to see the spirit of Kathy penetrate the media. You know, why not have a media embedded in, you know, in the ranks of the peacekeepers, and that sort of thing. That's, I mean, I call myself a peace journalist, and I believe that is the, I mean, and I would love to see the idea of peace journalism penetrate, you know, into the mainstream media. It's you know, the voices out there that stand for peace are kind of few and far between at this point.
You
but
know,
I have enough hope that, you know, that the movement will grow. I keep learning about that, you know, there are people out there that, you know, other people out there that believe in, they call themselves peace journalists and, you know, and devote their skills as writers and journalists to, in one way or another, writing about what peace means, which is the complex story. Peace is always the complex story. You know, war and violence are always the simple story.
Is there any hope, do you think, we can do where, I mean, teaching or training new journalists where we can get them to understand the total picture, or the need for real, true investigative journalism, or reporting all aspects of it?
Is there hope? Well, yeah. I mean, where I am discouraged is in the, you know, the corporate media has no wish for really, you know, independent, thoughtfully independent journalists out there challenging the status quo. I think, you know, certainly the hope is on the internet, on the you know, the many outlets that where there is, you know, where those voices do find expression. There is a lot. The mainstream media no longer has the corner on news the way it once did. And the news is out there much more than it ever used to be, I think. I'm wrestling with your question as you answer it, or as you ask it. Is there hope to train journalists? I think journalists go into the profession with lots of idealism. And what's really needed is encouragement and the opening of doors for that kind of journalism to actually find expression. And the large papers, the mainstream papers, are doing that probably less than they ever have, because they are so desperate to continue to make a profit, or to keep the cash flow coming at all, that they're not stepping outside the corridors of power. They're not really doing that. So is there hope? I don't have a good answer for that. I think there is hope in that a lot of people want to do it, and there are lots of voices out there, but they're marginal in terms of the mainstream media, and I'm not sure what it's going to take to create a mainstream that recognizes and honors the complexity of peace. I'm not sure what that's going to take how that's going to come about.
It seems like, when you listen to the evening news, no matter what station you have, it seems to me like the same person writes the story, whether
yeah.
What is going on? Is it just like, I'll switch it here. It's almost a word from word. Oh, no, I go to another station. And it's like,
yeah,
you're bombarded over and over again by a specific message that's almost been written by the same person, no matter which source you go to.
Right.
And the average person's got to be lost, because I think, you and I have talked about this, and it's frustrating to me. The average education that the individual has about the world and world politics and medicine or health or safety or science is so deficient that it seems sometimes they don't even know the truth when they hear the truth, or they don't know how to search out the truth.
Right. Well, it gets at, one of my favorite expressions comes from the former Washington Post columnist Coleman McCarthy. Some years ago, he asked the question, why are we violent but not illiterate? In other words, there is education that teaches people how to read. No one is born knowing how to read. We can teach people how to read. There is no education that teaches people how to be nonviolent. There is very inadequate education, so nobody believes that's even a possibility. So when you talk about, educational deficiency, I think that's a big part of it, is that there's not even an awareness that nonviolent conflict resolution is not only possible, but 99.999% of the time, far preferable than any kind of violent conflict resolution. And we don't even act like we're aware of that. So we're not even going, huh? Why are you going in there with the guns blazing when, why is that our first way in? So the media aren't asking the question, and the public isn't asking the question. And
now, you've reported on some people where you actually have some courses, and there are people trying to work on conflict resolution.
Yes, absolutely.
What is happening there, or how successful, or can that spread, or what's going to, where is it at?
Well, I think it is spreading. It's under the radar, but it's spreading. I mean, there's a lot happening domestically. I mean, the term that I, and I've talked about this with you in the past, is that, you know, the term out there is restorative justice. It's a restorative practices. It's healing-based justice as opposed to punishment-based, you know, justice or the keeping of order. People, you know, it, you know, the central facet of restorative justice is the peace circle. People sit in a circle of equality with one another and speak their minds and their hearts. And this is done in a conflict situation. It's done when harm has occurred. The perpetrator or causer of the harm will sit and talk with the victim, with someone that's, you know, affected by the crime, and listen and hear the consequences of whatever action he took. I mean, it's an extraordinary thing that's happening in the public school system here in Chicago and in cities around the country and around the world, as a matter of fact. And there is a lot of stuff. There are a lot of things going on that are changing, but I don't think the media has as much awareness of that at this point. They're just beginning to it's just beginning to dawn on them that this is happening. It's not clear how to report this, how to write about stuff like this, when two people that hate each other suddenly look each other in the eye and understand each other. That's a heck of a story right there. But how do you report it? How do you report it? And it requires a whole different kind of media that's able to report and write compelling stories, but report stories that are complex. You know, it's simple to write about somebody shooting another guy or beating someone up. I mean, those are simple stories, and the blood flows, and it's attention-grabbing and all that. It's far more complex to write stories where people suddenly understand each other because they talked a situation through. I mean, in a couple of days, I'm going to be going off to the west side of Chicago, where there's some people I know are involved in a program that helps ex-offenders, people leaving prison, the prison system, back into the world, and it includes a circle that involves ex-prisoners and police officers, and usually these are like groups that are at war with each other, and but there are places in Chicago where this is, you know, it's not seen as a war or a conflict situation, us and versus them, but where they actually sit together and talk with each other. And I've seen it in high schools where, you know, kids, teenagers, and police will sit with each other and talk. And it's an extraordinary situation. Yeah. It's amazing.
You know, let's come down to the fundamentals of journalists. I mean, you've been a syndicated columnist, a journalist, an editor, and everything for a long, long time. What is it about the length of a story, or how long can a journalist write a story for publication in a newspaper or a syndicated columnist? I mean, with the stuff you and I have worked on, just for simple stuff, we'll bounce stuff back and forth, and we'll pull up documents. We'll have hundreds of pages of research and resource documents just for a minor, minor story. How many words can a journalist write, or how do they boil all that down without losing the sense of the essence? I mean,
what happens here? That takes a lot of work. I think one of the most worrisome things about the, you know, is certainly in the world of print journalism, you know, is, you know, fewer and fewer people, I mean, you know, can get, you know, can find, you know, fine paying jobs, you know, being journalists. It takes a lot of time. It takes a lot of time to read, analyze, and absorb tons and tons of information. But that's part of what good journalism is. I mean, it's talking to people and investigating and looking at stuff, but it's also just absorbing lots and lots of data, and then, but never losing sight of, the fact that you're writing it for the public. So you don't want to write, you don't want to speak in jargon. You don't want to speak, in lawyer talk or politician talk. You want to write to the general public. You want to write to, the guy in the red pickup truck or whatever. So you want to put it all in language that the ordinary reader can understand. And that takes, but that requires really, understanding a story on its own terms and then putting it into ordinary and common language and making it plain to the average reader. It takes a lot of...
Well, all of us got a lot of, everybody involved, we got a lot of education, some of the great schools and universities.
Yes.
What is the average comprehension level or average reading level of the general public? I mean, in the military, right. I know in the military, when I've written manuals or regulations, we're trying to figure it at a fourth or a fifth grade level.
Okay.
Where is it at in the general public, or is that so difficult to do, or is it... an average newspaper's got to hit to everybody, and it can't just hit to the elite or the educated. Or...
Right. Well, I think, it does. I think there is a way, is an idea. Back when I was, in my earlier job as a reporter for the local paper, Learner Papers, which is, covered the north side of Chicago, we kept talking about writing to the guy in the red pickup truck, there was a mythical person, but in other words, you tried to reach somebody, fifth, sixth, eighth grade reading level, whatever you want to call it. I don't know what level it was, but that did not mean writing down. I mean, that's not how I ever took it, as writing down or dumbing a story down. It just meant putting it in language that you took all the jargon out of it, and you put it in lively, vibrant and vital language, and you told the truth. And I think when the truth is there and it's written compellingly, people's reading level, comes up when they're reading something that's of vital interest to them. Even if they don't know all of the words, they will read and absorb and learn, and get what they can. So I think it's a matter of if you tell the truth. If you're not telling the truth, it can get very boring. If you are telling the truth, it's you can write in a sophisticated way and people will listen because you're telling the truth.
What about preconceived ideas or concepts or misconceptions? I mean, is that prevalent in today's?
Well, certainly, that's all out there. Everything is out there. All of that is. There's prejudices everywhere. Preconceived ideas are everywhere. And journalists have their own preconceived ideas. So. One of the basic fundamentals of journalism is fairness. We talk to, multiple sides in a story, and that's very crucial. And that's old-fashioned journalism, and it's also, current journalism. But you've got to, there's often a mockery done, especially when we're reporting, something, we're writing about politics or war. We don't give war from the side of, quote unquote, the enemy and that sort of thing.
We got about 5 minutes here left. You want to talk about your book a little?
Oh, sure. Absolutely.
And tell people how to get in touch with you and get in touch or read your book. It's an incredible book.
All right. Yeah, the book is called Courage Grows Strong at the Wound. And you can get information at my website, which is commonwonders.com. That will, tell you how to get, buy the book and that sort of thing. The book is one way I think of it is it looks at the idea of peace from the inside out, and and from the outside in, it goes from very personal stuff that happened in my life, losing my wife to cancer and a long battle with cancer, to 9/11. It goes through 9/11 and the, you know, the building of peace, the Winter Soldier movement, and the vets, and the, you know, coming home from Iraq and Afghanistan, and so it goes from the very personal to the very impersonal, from brokenness and the broken heart to the struggle to create a peaceful world. I mean, it sounds like it's taken off a big chunk, but that's what the book is about. It's a collection of, you know, essays and columns written over about a 5-year period. And, so that's what it deals with. And once again, the website is commonwonders.com, and the book is called Courage Grows Strong at the Wound.
Well, you know, it seems to me, as I read the book and read the stories, and, you know, we met some of the different people involved, that wound that all the soldiers have, or the wound that the individual feels,
yes,
what you're trying to say can really heal, and
yes,
the courage and everything that comes about from...
Yes, that's absolutely right. And I think that goes back to, you know, what is my connection with the vets? It is the wound. It is the wound, and they're healing themselves and growing strong in the deep wound that they have. And healing that wound, I think, is the essence of what peace is.
Now, once you heal that wound, can't the whole world open up where you can find new meaning and everything?
Absolutely.
And it can move on?
Absolutely. And I mean, I think that's what the healing process is. As you heal, that's what happens. I think so.
Do you run across vets that have given up hope?
Well, yes, of course. Absolutely. There are lots of them. You know, and some of them will commit suicide and that sort of thing. So there are lots of people that do give up hope, and it's very understandable, but I also run across a lot that do not.
What is the effect on the children and the families?
When they've given up hope?
When the wound and all this stuff, you've had to deal with this. What's the effect on the children and all this, and how do you get by that?
Well, it's crushing. It sets off a cycle that, or continues a cycle that goes from generation to generation. And yeah, so if a father or a parent has lost hope, you know, that will certainly open up a wound in the child. They won't understand it as a wound, but it'll be a wound, and it'll be there, you know, for the rest of their lives.
But recovery is possible, huh?
Yes, but recovery is possible. And so, you know, and the whole term "courage grows strong at the wound" implies that if we're injured in childhood, that's where our strength goes. I came upon the term, and it was a forgiveness workshop that someone was leading, and he used that term. It's an old Scottish expression, "courage grows strong at the wound," and. You know, and as soon as I heard it, I was unable to get it out of my head, and I wound up going, that has to be the title of my book.
I mean, it's a totally fascinating book. I mean, one that I would definitely recommend people to
read. Thank you. Thank you so much.
Is there anything in closing or leaving that you'd like to leave? I mean, you and I have known each other. We've worked together. I've given you references. You've given me references. You've gone out.
Absolutely.
People I've told you about, you've gone out and got help for them.
Yes.
Is there anything you'd like to leave our veterans or our listeners with today?
Well, I would say, yeah, don't give up hope. I think, and don't become cynical. I think the world is moving in the direction we want it to move. I think movements like restorative justice and ceasefire and these movements that, you know, for nonviolent conflict resolution are very powerful. And I think vets have so much to offer the world. Vets have so much to offer the world. Talk to young people and talk about your experiences and get involved and help us build a world, you know, that the world beyond war. I mean, that's what we've got to do. And so I would say that's what I would leave. Don't give up hope.
And your website again, so people can go look at on your book.
CommonWonders.com.
CommonWonders.com.
That's right.
Well, Bob Kaler, thank you very much. Thank you for everything you do for the veterans and the nation and children. And I mean, you're writing about everything where it needs hope and dreams.
Well, thank you so much, Doug. It's always a pleasure to talk to you. It really is. You are my hero. and all that you've done. So thank you so much.
Well, thank you, Bob. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much. Again, Robert Kaler, CommonDreams.com. And again, the name of the book, Bob?
Courage Grows Strong at the Wound.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, recommend you find out, and you can talk to Bob and contact him, and never know, you might end up with a story all across nationwide.
Absolutely.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen, and good evening.
Good night.